You are listening to the Already Gone podcast. For this, episode 1 of the 3rd season, we are discussing a series of murders that occurred in the Detroit area in 1976 and 1977 in a case known as the Oakland County Child Killer. The mid-70s was an interesting time to be a Detroiter. In July of 1975, Teamsters president Jimmy Hoffa would vanish from a Bloomfield Hills eatery, leading to a mystery that persists to this day. Talk to anyone who lived in the area during that time, and they have a theory on who did Hoffa and where his remains ended up. My pet theory is that Hoffa was murdered, cremated, and his ashes were dumped on the lawn of Oakland County Prosecutor L. Brooks Patterson. Make a note of Patterson's name, because you're going to be hearing it again. In 1975, Michigan native Gerald Ford was in the White House, and he would soon be replaced by a peanut farmer from Georgia, the Navy veteran and nuclear engineer Jimmy Carter. 1976 also brought the bicentennial, the 200th birthday of the United States. Before we get too far into this story, I want to clarify something. Oakland County is a nice place. It's a safe place, and yes, there is a lot of money in some areas of the county. If you look up Oakland County on national rankings, it's often in the top 10 to 15 wealthiest in the nation, on par with Orange County, California, Nassau County, New York, and Fairfax County in Virginia. The settings of this story, for the most part, are not in the wealthy areas of Oakland County. Our story takes place in South Central Oakland County, along the Woodward Avenue corridor, and just north of the Detroit border. The first abduction occurred just north of the 8 Mile that Eminem made famous with his music. The victims targeted by the Oakland County Child Killer were not from gated mansions or from homes with staff. They lived in Royal Oak, Ferndale, Berkeley, and the final victim came from Birmingham. It's an upscale address, but he did not come from a wealthy family or a palatial home. Listeners, be aware we are headed down a very dark road. This case has all the worst elements: kidnapping, murder, sexual assault, and the victims are prepubescent children. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Between 1976 and 1977, 4 Oakland County children were abducted, held for days, and murdered. After years of dead ends, the Oakland County Child Killer case has been heating up in recent weeks.
I will refer to this killer or killers as the Oakland County Child Killer. I've seen him referred to as the babysitter, but I never heard him or them called that. He, or possibly they, are the Oakland County Child Killer, a nameless, faceless boogeyman who committed unspeakable acts against 4 Oakland County children over a span of 13 months. Someone who changed the way we lived, a predator who took something away from our neighborhoods and our communities. Someone who isn't fit to live among us, but it's possible that he still does. From 1976 until 1977, the Oakland County Child Killer picked 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, to kidnap, assault, and murder. 3 of the 4 victims were cleaned, with their clothing and bodies washed. 3 of the 4 victims were neatly placed on their back by the side of the road, except for the last victim. His small body, still warm, was tossed on the side of a snow-covered Wayne County road along with his beloved skateboard. 3 of the 4 victims died by smothering. The 4th was killed with a shotgun. All 4 were kidnapped and dumped during the cold winter months, when full dark happens before 6 p.m. and houses are closed tight against bitter Michigan weather. February 15th, 1976. 12-year-old Mark Stebbins is watching a billiards tournament with his mother and older brother at the American Legion Hall in Ferndale. Preferring watching television to watching billiards, Stebbins decides to head home on foot, alone. It's the middle of the day, but Mark doesn't make it to his house. His family, particularly his older brother Mike, who'd been with him that afternoon, search relentlessly for Mark, but there is no sign of him. Late that evening, his mother calls Ferndale police to report her son missing. Mark is described as 4'8" tall, 100 pounds, with reddish blonde hair and blue eyes. He was wearing a blue jacket with a hood, black boots, and blue jeans. Ferndale police try to reassure the single mother, "Your son will turn up. It's been a decade since the last kidnapping in Ferndale." 4 days later, an office worker heads out to get lunch around 11:45 in the morning. He spots a body discarded behind a strip mall. Mark's body is found near the intersection of 10 Mile Road and Greenfield Road in Southfield. As police canvass the area, they speak with a man who was walking his dog at 9:30 that morning. If the body was there during the walk, his dog would have noticed it. This gives police a 2-hour window for when the body was dropped in that location. Autopsy determines that the 12-year-old boy died by smothering. Someone pressed his nostrils closed and held a hand over his mouth until he was dead. The autopsy also reveals small cuts on the back of his head, bruising around his wrists, and signs of sexual assault. The bruises on his wrists tell investigators that Mark was restrained and he struggled against the ties. In the days after Mark's funeral, something else is left in the location where his body was discovered. It's a prayer card for Mark's visitation. When Mrs. Stebbins is pressed by police, she admits she did not know or recognize all of the mourners. Could the Oakland County child killer have attended his service? Mark's death weighs heavily on Mike's mind. What if he'd accompanied him home that afternoon? What if? What if? By his own admission, Mike would turn to drugs and bad choices to console himself. Mark, who'd wanted to join the Marines when he finished high school, would never have that opportunity. Living in the dark shadow cast by his absence, Ruth Stebbins and her remaining son struggle to get through each day. In December 1976, Jill Robinson, a 12-year-old girl who lived in Royal Oak with her mother and sister, was having nightmares. Jill's little sister, Aline, who was about 9 years old, recalled that Jill would wake up from horrible dreams, dreams where someone shot her. Aline would fetch their mother to comfort Jill and help her get back to sleep. Jill's parents were divorced. She lived with her mother, and her father lived in Birmingham. On December 22nd, the start of winter break, Jill and her mother were arguing about chores, a dispute that every parent has with their child at some point. Feeling put out, Jill left the house, telling her little sister, "I'm going to see my dad." Jill put a blue and green plaid blanket into a denim backpack and dressed warmly in winter boots, an orange winter coat, and a blue knit cap before departing on her bicycle. Jill never made it to her father's house in Birmingham. Her bike was discovered behind a hobby shop on Woodward Avenue. It's unknown if she left the bike there or if someone else put it there. The morning of December 26th, her body was found along Interstate 75 in Troy. Jill had been shot in the head at close range. If you stood in the location where she was found, you can see the Troy City offices, including the Troy Police Department. Police asked motorists if they'd seen anything in this heavily traveled corridor, and the tips poured in, including multiple mentions of a mid-60s Pontiac on the side of the road around 4:30 a.m. Further, that the Pontiac had damage to the rear bumper and possibly some primer on those spots. That's a distinctive vehicle to look out for. I would like to tell you that the crime scene was sealed off, photographed, and evidence scrupulously collected. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. I've read in multiple places that no evidence technicians were called to the scene. Michigan State Police and the Oakland County Sheriff have very capable crime scene analysts. Why they weren't photographing, gathering, and protecting the scene is a mystery. Because Mark Stebbins was smothered and left in the Southfield parking lot, and Jill was shot and left along the side of Interstate 75, a connection may not have immediately been made between the two cases. I've read that Mark's clothing was dirty and soiled, but Jill was neatly dressed in clean clothes, the same ones that she'd worn when she left on the 22nd. Jill's body was clean, her nails trimmed. She was wearing her denim backpack, which contained the plaid blanket. Why was Jill shot, unlike Mark and unlike the next two victims? I've seen a couple of theories on this. One, Jill was smothered like the other victims, but she was only unconscious, not dead. When placed in the snow, she stirred, and in a panic, the killer shot her, making sure that she was dead and gone. A second theory, and one that I favor, is that Jill was wearing her backpack when she was left on the side of the road. So when her body was laid out, the bulk of the backpack caused air to be expelled from her lungs. Fearing that Jill was still alive, he panicked and shot her. It's very likely that the Oakland County child killer was carrying a weapon in case his task was interrupted. If you're wondering how many child murders there can be in one area, let me tell you about a couple of other cases from the same time frame. In January of 1976, the month before Mark Stebbins was taken from Ferndale, that was a brutal month for teen girls in Metro Detroit. On January 15th, 16-year-old Cynthia Cadju of Roseville was raped and murdered, her nude body dumped on the side of the road in Bloomfield Township. In 1981, Bobby Anglin, who was never a suspect in the Oakland County child murders, was charged in her death. On January 19th, Sheila Srock, a 14-year-old girl, was babysitting in a Birmingham home. She surprised a burglar who quickly overpowered her. He raped her, shot her several times, and slipped out of the house with the items he'd stolen, hiding in plain sight among onlookers who'd come out at the sound of gunfire. Oliver Andrews would confess to her murder and be sentenced to life in prison almost 3 years later in January 1979. Oliver Andrews was never a suspect in the Oakland County child murders. Before moving on to the next victim, I'm going to bring up a name from an earlier episode, Dr. Robert Sillery. If you listened to episode 4 about the death of Deborah Rentschler, the 18-year-old prostitute whose body was dumped outside of a building in Farmington, Michigan on Christmas Eve 1980, you might recognize his name. If you haven't listened, I can give you the short version. Dr. Sillery was a medical examiner for Oakland County. On December 26th, 1980, I'm sure he arrived to work in a backlog of bodies waiting for his attention because of the holiday. Sillery looked at the body of Deborah Rentschler, a girl whose mother died when she was small, and as a child, she was bounced from family member to family member. As a teen, Deborah ran away, got into trouble, and began using drugs. And by 17, she was working a corner on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. The harshness of her life was spelled out on Deborah's skin. She was thin, pale, her flesh dotted with needle marks, homemade tattoos, and bruises. Dr. Sillery, who lived in a gracious home in a good neighborhood and sent his own daughters to college, read the notes that stated that Deborah was a Detroit resident, that her body was found naked, face down in a snowbank 21 miles from her home, and with that information, Sillery decided that Deborah Rentschler's death must be from natural causes. Because she hadn't been through enough in her short life, Deborah's body would be exhumed in April of 1981, and a second autopsy performed at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. While her body showed the ravages of addiction, she died by strangulation. Dr. Sillery's findings were vacated, and police were finally able to pursue Deborah's death as a murder. Dr. Sillery will perform autopsies on the female victims of the Oakland County child killer. In case you were wondering, Deborah Rentschler's murder remains open and unsolved. We'll be coming back to Dr. Sillery. He still has work to do on this case. January 2nd, 1977. Deborah Ashcroft calls the Berkeley Police Department to report that her 10-year-old daughter, Christine Mihalik, is missing. Christine, known as Chris, was last seen at a convenience store on 12 Mile Road in Berkeley. A clerk at the store recalled selling a magazine to a girl matching Chris's description around 3 p.m. that day. The convenience store was a block or two from her home on Gardner Avenue and located just across the street from where her mother worked. On January 3rd, Chris Mihalik's face is on the cover of every newspaper, it's posted in every police station, and it's shown on every morning news program. All of Metro Detroit is looking for Chris Mihalik. The manhunt was tremendous, with law enforcement encouraged to stop vehicles that could be related to the case. Be polite, but be thorough. Leave no stone unturned. Unlike with previous victims, Chris's body doesn't turn up after a couple of days. I wonder if this made law enforcement hopeful that she wasn't another victim of the Oakland County child killer. After all, Jill and Mark were only kept for 4 days, but 19 days after she vanished, a mailman, Jerome Wozni, was delivering mail in the upscale suburb of Franklin Village. While on his route, Wozni kept an eye out for discarded valuables. On this day, he came across a bundle on Bruce Lane, a dead-end street on the south side of 13 Mile Road. When he stopped his mail truck to investigate, he saw a hand and then an arm. Christine Mihalik was no longer missing. She'd been laid on her back, her knees bent, and was mostly concealed by the fresh snow that had fallen. Wozni retreated to his vehicle and drove directly to the Franklin Village Police Department, a force of half a dozen officers that served the well-heeled residents of this tiny community. Chris's mother said that her daughter was a delight and finds small comfort in the idea that they kept her girl as long as they did because Chris was such an engaging and enjoyable person right up until the end. On January 4th, just a week ago, I took a drive down 13 Mile and turned down Bruce Lane. The dead-end street is lined with expensive homes built long after Chris Mihalik's body was found. And while the temperature that day was in the single digits, the chill that I felt was not from the weather. Let's pause here for a moment. We've covered a lot of ground, literally and figuratively. Mark Stebbins was last seen in Ferndale, and his body was found in Southfield. Jill Robinson was last seen in Royal Oak, and her body was found in Troy. Chris Mihalik was last seen in Berkeley, and her body was found in Franklin Village. 3 victims, 6 cities, 6 different police agencies, plus the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and I'm sure that the Michigan State Police were called in since Jill Robinson's body was found on Interstate 75. Also, the Oakland County Medical Examiner, and while we're talking about Oakland County agencies, the Oakland County Sheriff was involved as well. It's their county. L. Brooks Patterson, who I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, was the county prosecutor. I'm certain that Brooks was applying pressure to the investigating agencies. Oakland County was still reeling from the gruesome unsolved murder of Joshua Doerr in 1974, and the news still reported breathlessly about the high-profile disappearance of former Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa in 1975. This case was something different. 3 dead kids and not a single arrest. I'm sure Brooks was eager to see this move forward. Before we get to our 4th and final victim, we need to return to the office of the medical examiner. Dr. Sillery is wearing his white coat, and he's taking a look at the body of Christine Mihalik. His findings may surprise you. They certainly raised eyebrows among law enforcement. Dr. Sillery performed the autopsy on both female victims of the Oakland County child killer. Mark Stebbins' autopsy was performed by Oakland County's Dr. Patinga, and the autopsy of the 4th and final victim was performed by Dr. Werner Spitz, another name that you may have heard previously. Dr. Sillery stated that while Chris Mihalik was found in the snow, she'd been left outside hours before she was discovered, and her body was not frozen through, meaning she'd only been there a little while when her body was found. Dr. Sillery reported that her body showed no signs of sexual molestation, yet Dr. Sillery insisted that he found sperm in both her vagina and rectum. He could not account for how they'd gotten there, but he had theories. Understandably, the investigators did not trust his results. Another pathologist and 2 state police lab techs reviewed the samples and could not detect sperm in the tissue slides he'd prepared. There was no sperm because Christine, like Jill, had not been violated. It seems that Dr. Sillery was doing shoddy work long before Deborah Rentschler was on his table at the end of 1980. Mihalik's mother would point out to investigators that the shirt Chris was wearing tied in the back, but when her body was found, the shirt had been tied in the front, making it likely that Chris did not dress herself. Like Jill, her clothing was clean despite her being held for almost 3 weeks. This case put tremendous pressure on law enforcement, and parents and families were terrified. 3 children, victims of horrific murder at the hand of an unknown perpetrator, clear escalation in the pattern, with Chris being taken just 10 days after Jill was found. Schools were suddenly clogged with parents driving their kids to and from school each day. Previously, children would walk to school or take a bus, but that no longer seemed like a safe or practical option. When parents couldn't escort their children each day, they called on friends, neighbors, and even the schools themselves to provide a buddy for their child to walk with. Oakland County Sheriff Johann Spreen said, quote, "A few months ago, if a kid didn't come home after school, the parents would wait it out. Now, law enforcement is contacted almost immediately." Schools did their part as well, holding assemblies about stranger danger and encouraging the children to watch out for one another. On January 27, 1977, police followed up on a tip and decided to interview Christopher Bush. Bush is notable for a couple of things. One, he was already known to law enforcement as a pedophile, and at age 27, he had multiple arrests for criminal sexual misconduct with minors. Back on January 25th, Gregory Green, a friend and associate of Chris Bush, was arrested up in Flint. Green told police that he knew who had murdered Mark Stebbins in early 76. Whatever information Green gave law enforcement, it was enough for Flint police to pick up Bush and bring him in. Looking at our timeline, it was 3 days earlier, on January 25th, 1977, that Chris Mihalik's body was discovered by a mailman on his route through the upscale enclave of Franklin Village. There are three deaths linked to this killer. The abduction of Timothy King is still several weeks in the future. A group of police from different agencies sat in on the interview with Bush. The bearded, obese, 27-year-old told law enforcement that he and Green had talked about how they could kidnap kids and alternate their work schedules so the kid was never alone. And during this interview, Bush reportedly told law enforcement that he liked to pick up kids on Nine Mile Road in Ferndale, which is where Stebbins was taken from, and on 12 Mile in Berkeley, which is where Mihalik was taken from, and from the large shopping plaza at the corner of 13 and Woodward, which is the location where Jill Robinson was last seen. Gregory Green and Christopher Bush are each held on $75,000 bond. Green will never be a free man again. Green was sent to prison where he would die of heart failure in the 1990s. Whatever secrets Green had, he kept his mouth shut and he did his time. Christopher Bush has a very different experience. Like Green, he was held in the Genesee County Jail. This right here is another extremely frustrating part of this case. Bush was being held on $75,000 bond, but someone crossed that number out and changed it to $1,000. Bush, who had multiple counts of criminal sexual misconduct charges pending against him, had his bond reduced and was released. January of 1977, Christopher Brian Bush has charges pending against him in four counties in Michigan: Genesee, Montmorency, Oakland, and Midland County. Who would authorize his release? There are only a few people powerful enough to make that happen. One of them is the Oakland County prosecutor, L. Brooks Patterson. Patterson could have been pressured by the Bush family to get their son out of jail. The other entity with that sort of sway? General Motors. H. Lee Bush, father of Christopher Bush, was the chief financial officer of General Motors. Think back to the Nancy Ludwig, Margaret Eby episode. Margaret Eby lived in the gatehouse at the Applewood Estate, which was built by Charles Mott, who was an executive and chairman at General Motors. General Motors built Flint, which is located in Genesee County, and in 1977, they were an extremely powerful and significant influence in the community. So Christopher Brian Bush is released and returns to his home on Morning View Terrace in Bloomfield Township. It's a lovely home, a large brick house with a maid that came each week to keep things clean. And Bush lived there by himself for the most part. His father traveled frequently for work, and his mother accompanied her husband on the trips. Chris's brothers had long since moved away, so most of the time it was just Chris and his dog, a white Welsh terrier. I'd like to have a look at the travel schedule of H. Lee Bush in 1976 and 1977, and I'd like to know if his travel dates coincide with the abductions of Mark Stebbins, Jill Robinson, or Chris Mihalik. Wednesday, March 16th, 1977. Timothy King, a slender, athletic 11-year-old boy, borrows some money from his sister and takes his skateboard to the local drugstore to buy candy. He's seen in the parking lot of the drugstore talking to a man while a second man looks on from a parked car. Witnesses provide a partial license plate, 222, and a description of the vehicle, a Pontiac Le Mans or similarly styled Buick, blue or green in color. If you do some reading online about this case, you will see a blue gremlin mentioned over and over again. The gremlin is thought by many people to be a red herring and that the Pontiac Le Mans is the vehicle to focus on, or the mid-60s Pontiac with the rear bumper damage and the primer spots that was seen the morning Jill Robinson's body was found on I-75. So Timothy King is gone. He's vanished. He doesn't come home. Police spring into action again, and Timothy's mother, Marion King, goes on TV and pleads with the perpetrator, "Please return my son. Please bring back my little boy." She says she will take Tim for his favorite meal, Kentucky Fried Chicken. Timothy's father reassures his son about missing baseball tryouts, that it's okay, he can try out next week. The coach said that's fine. Police presence and media coverage was frenzied, and I believe that the Oakland County child killer felt the pressure because his movements changed. Up until now, victims were dropped in South Central Oakland County. The bodies were neatly placed on the side of the road on their back, but not Tim. He was unceremoniously dumped on the west side of Gill Road, just south of 8 Mile, in Livonia, Michigan, Wayne County this time. Timothy's skateboard was beside him. His clothes were clean and freshly washed. He'd been bathed, and his nails were trimmed and scraped. When Dr. Werner Spitz performed the autopsy, he made a note that Timothy had consumed, quote, a meal of fowl, end quote, about an hour before his death. In other words, Timothy King was fed fried chicken. Was this a coincidence, or had the Oakland County child killer seen Marion King on television pleading for the return of her son? Was this a taunt like the funeral card left at the site Mark Stebbins' body was found? Timothy King's body was still warm when he was discovered, leading to another problematic crime scene. Police and paramedics worked him on the side of the road, hoping to revive the boy. Any tire tracks, footprints, hairs, fibers, they were either trampled or contaminated. I can't lay blame on the first responders. They were trying to save him, the small, dark-haired 11-year-old who played hockey and baseball, the youngest child in the King family. He was still wearing his Birmingham hockey jacket. It was red nylon and covered with patches. It probably looked a lot like the jackets worn by the sons of the men who responded to the scene that day. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, residents of Oakland County, people who lived through this, they remember it. One friend, now in her 60s, told me that she was stopped at a convenience store buying cigarettes when a series of police cars flew past, sirens wailing, lights flashing. First Southfield PD, then Franklin, followed quickly by a sheriff's vehicle from Oakland County. Minutes passed and additional cruisers kept coming. The chill in the air wasn't the snow of late March. Timothy King was no longer missing. Spring of 1977 meant that the snow melted and there were no more victims for now. The Oakland County child killer, apart from how he or they had dumped Timothy King, was a consistent creature. Take victims in the winter during the cold months, hold them for a few days, then dump them on the side of the road in Oakland County. Smother them first. Yes, Jill Robinson was shot, but we discussed the likely reason for the departure from his pattern. Other similarities. Two of the victims were picked up on a Sunday and two on a Wednesday. All of the victims were fed, cleaned, and dressed in their own clean clothing prior to being dumped. Although I've read that Mark Stebbins was clean, but his clothing was not. Both boys, Mark and Timothy, showed signs of being restrained and sexually abused. The female victims were not sexually assaulted, at least not in a way that could be determined at autopsy. None of the victims were forcibly taken. They must have agreed to go with their attacker, as no one witnessed the abduction. In January of 1977, law enforcement realized that the many agencies working on these crimes was as much of a hindrance as it was a help. They needed to pool resources, streamline their work. There were thousands of tips pouring in about this case. In March of 1977, the agency set up shop at a recently closed elementary school in Beverly Hills, Michigan. Beverly Hills is a small city adjacent to Birmingham and Royal Oak, where Timothy King and Jill Robinson lived. It was a good central location for the investigators to operate from. Multiple phone lines were installed. The school had a large parking lot to accommodate the investigators, a PA system to help route calls, and a large kitchen. It was nearly perfect. As an aside, this building is still in use today. It's now a private religious school. Because it's 1977, all the tips are tracked manually. A rudimentary computer system was eventually used to organize the information. Could a case like this go unsolved today? If tips and information were shared almost instantly, if data was tracked and logged and sorted in a way that would easily rule out some tips while pushing others to the top? While the last three victims were washed and cleaned, their nails scraped, their clothing laundered, would enough trace evidence be left behind? Working this case are dozens of investigating agencies, more than 100 investigators, plus four medical examiners, sharing information in a way that made sense and allowed productive investigation. I can't imagine how complex that must have been. Mid-March 1977, the task force reached out to postal workers, meter readers, utility workers, and real estate agents. These groups were receptive to helping find this killer, and they are told to look out for a white male, 5'8" to 5'10", 20 to 35 years of age, and they're shown a sketch and told about the blue gremlin with the white stripe. We're going to keep coming back to this car, but the blue gremlin seen at the drugstore where Tim King was abducted was still there when his older brother Chris went looking for him later that evening. As of 2012, the gremlin was still being discussed in the press when stories surfaced about the case. The task force called on police departments in 18 communities in Oakland and Wayne County, asking that they go through their records going back to January 1, 1975, to see if any crimes or criminals matched up with the current cases. They were looking for things like rape, sodomy, molestation. The task force also extensively interviewed the families of each victim, looking at things like medical history, work history, education, transportation, sporting and recreation activities. They were trying to find overlap, places that the perpetrator could have decided to target the victim or the family. The Oakland County Child Killer Task Force has a generous budget and a tremendous amount of manpower, with more than 100 detectives and 18 troopers from the Michigan State Police, and they work this case through the summer of 77, hoping to find the guy to get their man. Despite the descriptions of a blue car, most often a gremlin, although the Le Mans is mentioned occasionally, despite sketches and rewards. Did you know that one of the big newspapers, the Detroit News, offered a $100,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in the case? All of this and nothing happens. Thousands of tips come in. People reporting their ex-boyfriend, their mean boss, the creepy neighbor. People with the misfortune to drive a blue AMC gremlin are pulled over time and again, just in case. Parents continue to shuttle their children to and from school each day. The well-funded task force follows up on leads, but most of them are dead ends. The summer of 1977 ends and kids return to school. Halloween decorations go up. The leaves turn and that familiar chill fills the air. But there are no solid suspects, no strong leads. The task force headquarters in Beverly Hills remains a hive of activity. November comes and there isn't an arrest. Suddenly it's December. The task force and her loved ones mark the anniversary of the disappearance and death of Jill Robinson. What they don't know in 1977 is that there is both good news and bad news. The good news is that there will be no more victims of the Oakland County child killer. The bad news is that this case isn't going to be solved, despite millions of dollars, thousands of tips, tens of thousands of man hours, dozens of departments, countless news reports, documentaries, and articles. It's still open, and it's still unsolved. The Oakland County child killer will become another enduring Michigan mystery, alongside the disappearances of both Jimmy Hoffa and the Skelton brothers, and the unsolved murders of the Robson family and Harvey Leach. The case is cold. There isn't any justice for the perpetrators, and there is no sense of closure for the families left behind. It's been 40 years. It's time for the people who know more to speak up. If you have information about the identity of the Oakland County child killer, please contact Detective Sergeant Becky MacArthur of the Michigan State Police, Metro North Post, at 248-584-5740. This concludes part one of the Oakland County child killer. Next week, we will explore the suspects, the evidence, and what's next for the case. Listeners are invited to join the Already Gone podcast discussion group on Facebook. I will be posting links and photos there, as well as on our website at alreadygonepodcast.com. You can find me on Twitter at alreadygonepod. If you have questions, comments, or feedback, email me, host@alreadygonepodcast.com. As always, thanks go out to Luke Superior. He also grew up in Oakland County, and he creates the music you hear each week. If you want to hear more from Luke, check him out on SoundCloud.